latest from the circus in Sacramento? Some politicians want to allow grocers to charge you a fee for these bags, while banning this recyclable bag that's actually better for the environment. You see, the politicians have taken millions from the grocers to support their billion-dollar cash grab that would kill California jobs. Help put an end to the Sacramento clown show. Say no to SB 270.
Well, Governor Jerry Brown did not say no to SB 270. That's the law he signed earlier today that bans single-use plastic bags. We'll have more on that later in the show. But first, another bill the governor signed this week, this one about sex. The Yes Means Yes law, as it's known, makes California the first state in the nation to try to take the ambiguity out of sexual consent on college campuses. Try is an important word here because while yes means yes sounds good on paper, there are lots of questions about how it will be interpreted. Sophie Karasek is a sexual assault survivor and student at UC Berkeley, and she's a supporter of the new law. At Berkeley, she's been advising students on what she calls mini consent workshops at parties, and she has stepped out of class right now to speak to us. Welcome back to Press Play, Sophie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you back. And tell us exactly what this new law changes on campuses.
Sure. So this, as you mentioned, is the first time that this has ever happened in the country, where now there's an affirmative consent standard for college students. So that means that instead of saying that someone said no, and therefore that means that they didn't want to engage in sexual activity, it means that you have to say yes or otherwise indicate non-verbally through body language that you consent to sexual activity.
And does this have to happen at every stage of the encounter? So going from kissing to something more at each stage, there has to be some kind of affirmative consent?
Yeah, it's supposed to be whenever you decide to take a step further, then you're supposed to ask if that person is okay with that. And that's something that's really important and something that sexual assault survivors have been pushing for a long time.
But some people are saying, well, how would that work? I mean, you're in the heat of the moment and you're kind of, you know, losing your self-consciousness, or at least that's what people say you should be doing if you want to have good sex. And how can you sort of stop and say, okay, is this okay or mm-hmm. yes or is that?
So for example, what I've been teaching students at the mini consent workshop is how to actually ask for consent. And it's a lot easier than people think from the outset. So just asking, is this okay, actually does work. It's not that difficult to do. So for example, at these mini consent workshops, I asked, how would you ask for consent? And some students said very directly, I would ask, is it okay, do you want to have sex? Or they would say, is this okay? And that was a lot easier because it wasn't as direct, but you still knew what the partner was talking about. And a lot of students knew these answers right away. A lot of students are already pretty educated about consent, but several students hadn't heard of this before and were really grateful that I had explained this to them. So I think that education is definitely a really important part of this bill being successful.
What about nonverbal cues?
Yeah, so for example, if someone wanted to nod their head or shake their head, that's also acceptable. A lot of communication between people just in general is done through body language. So that is something that is important and is also being considered here.
And then, but it still may come down to, you know, during a disciplinary procedure, a he said, she said situation where someone might say, oh, she definitely nodded her head. And then she says, no, I didn't. I was shaking my head. I mean, there seems to be a lot of room for ambiguity and interpretation.
Sure. But it still is a different standard, right? It's saying that what we're prioritizing is whether or not there was consent. So it's really meant to give the survivors more agency. And it's even though it is different, you know, even though there is some truth to what you're saying, that it can be still ambiguous, it is supposed to be prioritizing and leveling the playing field between assailants and survivors. Because right now you have a situation where the cards are stacked against survivors in investigations on college campuses. So we're not trying to say that assailants should be given priority or survivors should be treated better and that that is at the expense of the accused, but we're trying to make sure that the playing field is level and that these investigations are done impartially.
Do you think if this law had been on the books when you went before the panel at UC Berkeley after your sexual assault, do you think that you would have been treated differently?
Well, so at Berkeley, there actually wasn't even a panel. That's one of the issues is that hearings are very uncommon at Berkeley, which was pretty shocking to discover. But I think that in my specific case, I didn't actually say anything because I was afraid that something worse would happen to me if I said anything, but I did indicate that I wasn't consenting because I pushed him off. So I think in situations like that, then it is important to have an affirmative consent standard because you're asking the survivor, did you say yes? Did you indicate otherwise that you were agreeing to do this? And that is really important for cases where survivors might have been too scared to say anything or were under the threat of coercion or force or were in shock in that moment. And that's also really applicable to cases where date rape drugs are involved or where alcohol is intentionally used by perpetrators. A lot of these cases are done by serial perpetrators. So having an affirmative consent standard makes it easier to identify those serial perpetrators and make sure that students are safe on campus.
Is this enough? I mean, do you think that the legislature should have done more?
Well, yeah, I definitely think that there could be additional steps that we can take, but I think that this is a good initial step. I think ultimately what we're trying to create, what students have been working for, is to create a cultural shift. And a big part of that is changing the conversation from no means no to yes means yes and giving survivors that agency and changing the idea of sex as being something that's a conquest, something that women in particular don't feel comfortable voicing what their desires and their opinions are during the sexual activity. So I think that there are definitely more things that could be done, but I think that ultimately, we're trying to create a culture shift, and by changing this conversation from no means no to yes means yes, we are taking a really important step forward in doing that.
Sophie Karasek, senior at UC Berkeley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Are you a college student? What kinds of conversations are you having with your friends about this yes means yes law? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW PressPlay. Well, yes means yes sometimes in another kind of relationship, the one between doctors and drug companies. In an effort to get doctors to prescribe their drugs to patients, drug makers spend billions of dollars a year on meals, speaking and consulting fees, and other perks for physicians. Today, a new government database goes online that will list the money pharmaceutical companies spend on doctors. It's the result of something called the Sunshine Law. That's a provision of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Aaron Kesselheim is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he studies the pharmaceutical industry there. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, so anyone can look up their doctor in the database now and see if he or she has received some kind of money from a pharmaceutical company?
Yes. They can look them up on the website to see if they received money during the months of September to December 2013.
That's it?
Yes. For now, that's the okay. First step, and then next summer they will release the full year of 2014 theoretically. Now, again, there also are some exceptions. About a third of the physicians who receive money have been excluded from the data because there are the government is still working out to make sure that the details have been accurately composed. There have been other payments that have been labeled as trade secrets by the pharmaceutical industry and so are not also in the database. So it's not, it's a little bit less than a complete explanation of people's relationships, but it's the largest database we have thus far.
Well, what is the point of having the database in the first place? Is it to change physician behavior?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of different reasons. You know, over the last couple decades, marketing relationships between pharmaceutical and medical device companies and physicians have been have gotten a bit out of hand, and there have been a lot, you know, examples of physicians who have received a lot of money from companies, and there have been studies that have demonstrated a link between physicians' prescribing practices and their relationships with pharmaceutical and medical device companies. So I think that one reason for the database to exist is for these kinds of relationships to be more transparent so that patients can see them, and so that administrators at hospitals or academic medical centers can view them. And, you know, just so that there's less secretiveness about it, because in the past, when there has been, when there hasn't been transparency, these sorts of relationships have been abused.
Well, you know, some doctors are saying, and including the American Medical Association, which is not happy about this database, saying that patients and others could take the information out of context, that they could read into it more nefarious activities than actually exist, that the data could be inaccurate, all sorts of things that could unfairly punish or come down on individual doctors.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that the data are meant to, you know, if I was suggesting, if I was talking to a patient, I would suggest that they use the data to start a conversation and to, you know, ask their physician about the relationship that they have. You know, there are a lot of positive financial relationships between pharmaceutical companies and the pharmacy and physicians that, you know, the kind that enhance research and promote collaboration on developing innovative products. I mean, you know, those sort of things go on all the time. You know, I would say that there are a lot of studies out there of patients and their wishes, and I think that surveys of patients have consistently shown that patients want transparency in their physicians' financial relationships, especially ones that will that affect the kind of care that are delivered. And actually, some studies have shown that transparency in these sorts of circumstances improves the physician-patient relationship because it enhances the trust between between the physician and the patient. So I think that, you know, it remains to be seen. Obviously, this is just the first day. It remains to be seen how these data will end up being used by patients and others in the healthcare marketplace. But I see the potential for a lot of good to come from it.
Well, why not go even further and have an ethical requirement on the part of physicians when they are interacting with their patients to reveal whether or not they have been paid by pharmaceutical companies? It just in that one encounter, because this kind of relies on patients being proactive and actually searching out this information online.
It does. Arguably, that ethical requirement exists. I mean, I think that if I was a surgeon and was going to implant a defibrillator or something made by Medtronic, and I received, you know, $50,000 a year as a consultant for Medtronic, I arguably already have the ethical obligation to disclose that to my patients. So I think.
But does that happen?
I think it probably doesn't happen as often as it should. So, I mean, I think that the reason that this database exists is because of the fact that those kinds of disclosures don't happen as often as they should, and that there have been, you know, there have been a lot of documented abuses of those kinds of relationships, and that's why we're where we are today, and why we have this, why this database was included in the legislation, and why it finally has come to light, because that. Including, you know, having that kind of ethical obligation just sitting there in the background without any, you know, mandated disclosure through this, you know, this kind of a you know, website wasn't working as well as it should.
And do you think it would be a good idea to just ban the payments entirely, to just say, physicians, you cannot accept fees from pharmaceutical companies and medical device manufacturers?
Well, you know, I think that there are certain financial relationships that don't add anything to the healthcare delivery. I think that there are, on the other hand, certain financial relationships that are very important. So, you know, there are, you know, examples such as giving out free lunches or, you know, putting physicians on these things called speakers bureaus where a physician is paid to speak on behalf of a certain product. I think that those can be very damaging in terms of, you know, reducing trust and, you know, the view that patients have of the profession and in leading to non-evidence-based prescribing practices. On the other hand, you know, it's very important for physicians to be able to, you know, provide expert recommendations to companies when they're developing products. And when physicians, you know, a lot of the key research that goes on new drugs and devices occur via physicians at academic medical centers, and those kinds of relationships involve exchanges of money. So, you know, I don't think that a blanket ban would necessarily be appropriate, but I do think that there are certain relationships that are known to be widely abused and do not seem to have much redeeming value. That if they did go away totally, you know, I would be okay with that, certainly.
Aaron Kesselheim, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, more medical ethics questions. Why Ezekiel Emanuel says he'll be happy to die at 75. He is a medical ethics expert, and he helped the president create the Affordable Care Act. He says he's lived a full life, so why spend the end in decline? That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. So if you had a choice, how long would you want to live? For most people, the answer is, well, probably as long as possible. But not for Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's director of the Clinical Bioethics Department at the National Institutes of Health. He recently wrote an essay for The Atlantic called Why I Hope to Die at 75. And he joins me now to explain. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, how old are you now?
57.
Okay. So you've got, what, 18 years left?
You're sounding like my brother, yeah.
Which one? Rom or Ari?
Ari. He wants to live forever.
He wants to live forever. Well, probably most of us would say that if we had a choice, we'd rather live forever than live to 75. Why did you pick 75? That seems like an arbitrary number.
Well, first of all, as the article makes clear, I didn't choose the title, and it's not that I expect to die at 75. It's my choice at 75 is that I'm not going to do things where the justification is to live, it's going to make me live longer. So I'm not going to go to the doctor and have a procedure where the reason for the procedure is, oh, it'll allow you to live longer, or take this medicine, you'll be cured of this problem and you'll live longer. So I'll still get or will be willing to get palliative treatments, you know, if I've got pain or something. But I'm not going to do things to live longer. I fully expect to live past 75. But I do think if you look at declines in physical functioning, the increase in problems with physical disability. If you look at the changes, the mental changes we have, all of us as we age slow down in our mental processing, our short-term memory. We become much more distractible, can't focus on projects.
But that happens way before 75.
Speaking from personal experience.
And
Alzheimer's increases dramatically after 75. If you look at all of those things, I think the right balance is somewhere in the 75 region between, you know, likely to have a vibrant life and have a low chance of having severe physical and mental disability. So that's why I chose 75. But part of what I want to emphasize by the article and the real motivation is to get people to stop thinking about life in terms of pure quantity and to really think about life in terms of quality. Figuring out what the quality and meaning is, I think, much more important than just trying to live as long as possible.
So life expectancy today is 79, up considerably from 1900 when it was 47, even up from the 1970s. And you write about your own father's experience with aging. And, you know, he has had some declines, I guess, physically and mentally. But you say that he's happy. And I don't know how old he is. But
he says he's happy. That's the important thing. He says he's happy.
Okay.
And I think...
what's wrong with him saying he's happy? I mean,
nothing.
Okay.
I emphasize it. First of all, I emphasize in the article that, again, one of the reasons for writing the article is that we shouldn't just sort of thoughtlessly accept living a long time as the right goal. Second thing, he also says his life is very constricted and has been very reduced compared to what it was. And the things that give him satisfaction have also been reduced.
You don't advocate euthanasia. I know you're against that.
I've been against it for more than three decades now, yeah.
But what you're talking about is at a certain point in your life, you will turn down life-extending drugs, even antibiotics, if you got pneumonia.
Correct.
Tell me more about what you plan to do or not to.
So I do not think legalizing euthanasia-assisted suicide are right. And in part, a lot of the people who want those interventions tend to be depressed, hopeless, and I don't think that's the right answer. All right, you're depressed and hopeless and you want to end your life. All right, here's the pills. And I also think that when people die that way, in the cases that I've seen, it changes the memory of them in an adverse way. But it's very different than I'm not going to take medications, I'm not going to undergo heart surgery, I'm not going to undergo some procedures, again, where the reason for those procedures is it's going to prolong your life. You're going to live longer because of that. I do think that the pivotal intervention that really gets people hung up is the intervention of antibiotics. They seem easy. You get a skin infection, you get a pneumonia, just treat the infection regardless of physical state that you're going to return to, mental ability, are you demented now or later? I mean, people have a very hard time saying no to antibiotics, and I'm very clear, and I've been clear with my children and my advanced care directive for a very long time that, you know, I do view having too many antibiotics or using them so easily as a problem that I don't want to do and don't endorse, and it's especially a problem if it's simply, you know, if God forbid I get Alzheimer's and it's just going to return me to that Alzheimer's state.
But let's say you're not. Let's say you're totally healthy mentally and physically.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
And you get an infection and you need antibiotics, you'll say no, even though you're healthy otherwise?
That's right, after 75, yeah. I just don't think the goal here is to live as long as possible. The goal is to live a fully meaningful life. And I've said that now, God forbid I get run over or hit by bicyclists in Central Park where several people have been killed. You know, I've told my kids, it would be tragic. I will have lost this next time with you, but I will have lived a very, very good life, a very meaningful life. I will have contributed things. I will have had great joys. And you should recognize that. When you think of me, don't think of me, oh, God, we lost all these years with Dad. Think of me, he had a fantastic life. It happened
to
have been cut short.
Let me ask you this, though. Let's say you're 75 and everything's going well and you're still working and you're still contributing to society and you're still contributing to your family and you get this infection and you're still going to say, okay, that's it, lights out, I have nothing left to contribute, when in fact you might have many, many more things to contribute.
Yeah, well,
that's
going to be the real test, isn't it? Yes, I'm sticking to my position, and this issue of you're going to keep contributing, you know, all of us, the initial reaction almost everyone, or a good sizable number of people have to this is, oh, just, you know, there's my Aunt Millie, and there's this person, and there's this other person who, and they're all past 75, and they're still productive. And even you, Zeke, you mentioned in your article, collaborators. Someone just reminded me that the famous economist Kenneth Arrow, one of the original Nobel Prize winners in economics, still vibrant, engaged at 90. Yes, there are some people who are outliers. By definition, though, most of us are not going to be outliers, and because they're outliers. They, yeah, have superior brain plasticity. They have been able to contribute later in life. But, you know, we all have to be realistic. That's a few people. Most of us don't fit that category. And the fact that people name them somehow as an argument against, you know, the overwhelming statistics of a third to half of people at 85 are going to have Alzheimer's, a lot of physical disability, inability to walk a quarter mile or walk up 10 stairs. That's much more the probable outcome. And, you know, I think that's what we have to think about rather than, oh, I'm going to be an outlier. If you're an outlier, you know, you don't have to, you can ignore my thing. But your chance of being an outlier, you need to be realistic about it. They're rare. They're rare for a reason, and, you know, most of us, therefore, are not going to be in that category, and planning as if we're going to be in that category, I think, is one of the big tricks we play on ourselves.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, I wish you well for your next 18 years. Thank you very much.
When I'm 76, I'll cook you a meal, and then you can tell me if I'm still creative and...
Okay, I look forward to it.
Good.
Dr. Emanuel, he is director of the Clinical Bioethics Department at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and he wrote an essay from the most recent issue of The Atlantic called Why I Hope to Die at 75. Okay, what about you? Do you want to live as long as possible, no matter what? Or do you agree with Zeke Emanuel? You can share your thoughts by calling us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or join the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, comedian Hari Kondabolu on why he never does Indian American impressions. And then I'll help him write a few jokes. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For almost 20 years, New York University's Asian Pacific American Institute has offered residencies to journalists, poets, photographers, painters, and other artists. This year, for the first time ever, they've invited a stand-up comedian.
People are freaking out. People are freaking out about demographic changes. They're freaking out about immigration. I was watching CNN, which was my mistake to begin with. Interviewing a lady in Arizona who wanted stronger border security, and she said, we're just trying to bring this country back to the way it used to be. Lady, you're in Arizona. It used to be Mexico. What are you talking about?
That's comedian Hari Kondabolu. He got his start as an immigration rights activist in Seattle doing stand-up on the side. And since then, he's appeared on Letterman, Conan, and Kimmel, just to name a few. He's headlining at the Troubadour in L.A. tonight, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, congrats on this residency at NYU. What are you going to do there?
They said I could pretty much do whatever I wanted, which was kind of stunning. Because initially when they reached out, I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to have a lot of obligations. And like I travel and there, you know, I have things I'm working on. And I don't know if you want me to teach something. And they're like, no, we just want to support your work. And I asked them what that meant. And they said, that means you can do everything you're already doing, except you have institutional support and money to support that work. And I said, yes, I will absolutely do that.
Does that mean you get research help with your jokes?
I have not asked them for that, but that is actually awesome to have someone Google for me and do the basic Wikipedia research that I actively failed to do.
Because I've noticed in some of your routines, you explain jokes, like the provenance of them.
Yeah.
So maybe you need someone to help you with that.
I love that, like that aspect of what I do. It's weird, though, but it's kind of... I think it's over-education, so it's actually pretty consistent. Like, it makes sense that I'm at NYU this year, just because I feel like I went to a liberal arts school. All my jokes kind of sound like essays, so I, like, have my thesis. I set up the points. I give the background information. Instead of, like, getting to the conclusion, which is basically restating my thesis, I have a punchline. Sometimes.
Okay, let me play the rest of your bit about Mexico and the U.S. border that we started with earlier.
And the kind of racism that's directed towards Mexican people in this country doesn't even make any sense. Like, the racism is absurd. What are the major stereotypes you hear? Mexicans are lazy. But you also hear Mexicans steal all the jobs. How do those two things work together? How can you be lazy and still magically steal all the jobs? Well, that's easy. Some Mexicans are lazy and some Mexicans work really hard. Oh, you mean like all people? Like all human beings. If your argument is that Mexicans are like all human beings, well, then you're just a really racist. That's some piss poor racism. maybe you should get out of the racism game. Or hire a Mexican person to be racist for you. Clearly couldn't handle that job.
Do you consider yourself a political comedian?
No. I mean, it's useful for branding. So people kind of know, oh, I like this kind of thing. So this is a kind of thing I will go to. But it's weird because I don't see myself as doing political things on stage. Do you know what I mean? Like, to me, this is all observational. My lens happens to be a political lens. I can't help but see racism. I can't help but see oppression and things. Like, I see it immediately. It's not like I have to analyze it deeply. Like, I know what it is when I see it, and I start writing. So it's not like I'm thinking, how do I politicize this idea? It's like, I see it. I'm talking about it. I'm sharing my experiences. So I get it when you have to find a way to describe me to another person, why that's useful, and it's shorthand. But, like, you know, I don't do it. I don't see myself as that. And I think it's always weird when we get niched off. Like, if you have a point of view that's a little different or is strong, like, people have to niche you in a place. And it takes away from the shared experiences that we all have. Because at the end of the day, I don't want to be a great political comedian. I want to be a great comedian. And I want to make people laugh who might not agree with my politics. I want to make people laugh that don't get what I'm necessarily doing with the form. You know, like, I like to play with the form. I like to explain things out. Like, I want to get everybody. I want to find a way to get everybody. So, yeah, I know it sounds very typical artist, but I don't like labels, you know, but I don't. I just think they restrict the ability to do the work.
But it's harder, you know, when you're doing stand-up and you are making these jokes that are, well, they're political or just socially conscious, whatever you want to
sure.
say. These aren't just your typical mother-in-law jokes. Do you ever think, okay, I've got to think of the audience. I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to be
sure.
hectoring. I want them
sure.
to have fun.
I mean, early on when I started pushing myself as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old to write things that were from my point of view that was developing, there is certainly a degree of, like, soapbox, you know? Like, I have this space and I can say whatever I really feel like saying, but the idea of the punchline became secondary. And then as you grow and remember, oh, yeah, I can write a joke and I can just take these things I believe and find a funny way to express them and use the different kind of structures of comedy to write punchlines to this, I feel like, you know, I got better. And that's the important thing. All of this has to be funny. If there's no jokes somewhere in there, it's not a joke. It is a lecture. And that's not what this is supposed to be. So that's why you just have to remind yourself constantly, why are you doing this? You're doing this to make people laugh. Make sure you make people laugh. And sure, there are going to be crowds that don't get everything or don't like everything or don't understand why you're talking about what you're talking about. But, you know, if you're a pro, you figure it out. As long as I'm up there and I feel like I'm sharing my truth and the things that I believe wholeheartedly, then I feel like I'm doing fine.
You went to the London School of Economics.
Yes. I wasted a lot of money before I got here. So I went to the London School of Economics, LSE, to get a human rights master's degree. So it wasn't actually economics. It was like human rights law mixed with sociology. And the idea was when I got back home, I figured a human rights framework to the organizing work I was doing would be good. But along the way, when I was applying to LSE, I was living in Seattle, I got into the HBO Comedy Festival. I got on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I got a manager. And all of a sudden, I had all the infrastructure that many professional comedians have. And I was already more successful than I ever anticipated. And I had to make a decision. So I ended up going to London and getting the degree and writing the dissertation, doing all the work. And, you know, at the end of it, like, it seemed like, hey, I have this opportunity to do comedy. I never thought it was real. I'm proud that I got to get to this point in my, you know, educational career where I feel like, okay, my academic career, I've gotten a master's degree. I feel like I have that. And it felt like, okay, let me take the risk now. Now that I've have a little bit of safety and I've gotten a few things on the resume that I feel like a little bit safe about, like, I made the decision thoughtfully of, like, yeah, let me plunge into this and see what happens. I'm, like, shocked that people are interested in what I do. And I was shocked back then. I'm shocked now, especially when you're coming into a climate a few years ago where there weren't that many Indian Americans, like, in the media. There just weren't in any kind of media. And now you have, like, Aziz and Mindy Kaling and, you know, Cal Penn and Asif Manvi and so many people. And so it's certainly you know, at the time felt like a bigger risk. And now it feels like, you know, I'm among a lot of other folks, and that feels good.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Hari Kondabolu. He's headlining at the Troubadour here in L.A. tonight. His latest record is called Waiting for 2042, which is a reference to the year white people are supposed to hit minority status in the U.S. And let's take a listen.
But here's the bigger point. Here's the bigger point, right? 49% white doesn't make you the minority. That's not how math works, right? 49% white is only the minority if you think the other 51% is exactly the same, right? It only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way that works. Because that 51% is not a united front, okay? And it's easy to find out. Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, all right? I bet you the interaction might not be pleasant. I bet you it's not going to be like, hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty excited. You? 2042, am I right? That's not what's happening.
So do you think that's really basically the fundamental problem with the way white people see race in this country, that it's us against them?
I mean, I'm not going to say it's all white people, but certainly I think there is a degree of that. We see that the fact that that number is in the media and has been discussed for years says a lot. That means that people actually see race in this very simple way, and there's a fear. Because the thing is, it's an absurd thing. The whole thing is a construct. Race isn't real, and the fact that there is that fear is absurd. And it is enough people where it's relevant. There's enough people who talk about the country changing, we're losing the country, who is the we that you're referring to. And it's nonsense. I don't think we should be feeding into it. We should be breaking it down and realizing that race is made up. It's not real.
And speaking of these constructs, what kind of prejudices or assumptions do you have to encounter when you go out on auditions?
It's gotten better, but certainly there was a time where the parts I was getting often required accents, and whether it was like working at a convenience store or something else, and you're supposed to be comic relief where your accent is the joke, and I'd be told, well, you don't need to use an accent. I'm like, really? Then why is there broken English on this page? And then you get to the audition, and you do it with your voice, and you feel terrible about it, and then the person says, well, can you try it this way? And then you're like, oh, I know what this is now. So, there's that. And I think there's less of that than there used to be, but that still exists. The idea of people of color or immigrants in particular being comic relief, like an easy punchline, a funny voice for others to laugh at. So, there's still some of that, and it's unfortunate. I mean, I remember I auditioned for Iron Man 3 for the role of hip scientist. And I was excited, like, I can play hip scientist. I have, like, thick black framed glasses and, I live in Brooklyn, in gentrified Brooklyn. Like, I can play this part. And I remember telling the casting person, I've waited my whole life to play hip scientist. I'm excited about auditioning for hip scientist. And I auditioned for hip scientist. And then they asked, do you do accents? I'm like, why does hip scientist need an accent? Hip scientist does not need an accent. And I didn't get the part.
Who got the part?
I don't know. I kind of I didn't even bother. Actually, I haven't seen Iron Man 3. I was disgusted. Actually, I should watch Iron Man 3 to see, which sellout took it.
Now I'm going to look up who plays the hip scientist.
But they had my brother audition, too.
Really?
And then after I auditioned, I realized, it didn't really matter if he could act or not. They needed a brown dude. Like, you got it, like, after the fact, you're like, they just need to fill some diversity, like, have some people of color in it, just to have some people of color in it. And it had less to do with, who could act and who couldn't, so.
All right, I'm looking now. Do you
know
the name of
it? Who knows if they kept it in? It just said hip scientist. That's what it said.
There's pushy tabloid reporter.
No.
There's Mandarin Lookout. These are all.
Amazing. Like, amazing. Oh, Mandarin Lookout.
There's Scared Insurgent. There's Laughing Insurgent.
Well, I was going for Laughing Insurgent, and they said, no, you just don't have the chops.
Sleepy Mandarin Girl.
I should actually talk about this on stage. I don't know why
you
I don't.
You should, This is really, go to IMDb and you'll see all of this stuff.
That might be the whole bit. I might talk about my experience and then read the descriptions of other characters. I think that might... Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's very much in my wheelhouse. That's like, this is hilarious.
Well, thank you for coming on and talking to me. That was fun.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
That's Hari Kondabolu. He's a stand-up comedian, and his latest record is called Waiting for 2042. Tonight, he'll be headlining at the Troubadour. Tickets available at the door. That's going to be my second career, Warren Olney. I'm going to write jokes, or try to.
Which
at
of
least.
Those parts are you going to play?
I could play all of them, I think, especially right. Pushy tabloid reporter.
There you go. Either one of us could play that one.
Okay, so what's up at 1 o'clock?
Well, nothing gets people cranked up like the intersection of education and politics, and now the College Board is trying to change the advanced placement standards. The right is coming at it as negative about the country, not sufficiently patriotic. The left is coming back in the other direction. This is all playing out in a major suburb of Denver, right in the middle of an election, of course. And there also is a big dispute about textbooks in Texas. So we're going to be talking about that. It's one of the continuing controversies, of course, in American politics is what do we do about public education? How political should it be?
Okay. Well, look forward to that conversation, a vital conversation at 1 o'clock with Warren Olney and To the Point. And coming up on this program right before that, California is the first state in the union to ban plastic single-use bags. We're going to find out what that will do, if anything, for the environment next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, sorry, dog owners. Your endless supply of disposable plastic bags is about to dry up. Governor Jerry Brown signed a new law today that bans single-use plastic bags statewide. That's the kind you get at a grocery store or a shopping mall. Los Angeles became the biggest city ever to ban plastic bags last year. Now, California is the first state to do so. But what effect do plastic bag bans actually have? Katie Rose Quant is a senior editorial fellow for Mother Jones, and she looked into this very question. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, this ban, the statewide ban, takes effect in July, right?
Yes, July of next year.
Okay, and it applies to all single-use bags?
Yes, it will start with large grocery stores next year, and then it will roll into convenience stores and pharmacies the following year.
Okay, so why not just tax the bags instead of banning them outright? That would change consumer behavior, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, both have been enacted in different cities throughout the country. But currently, one-third of Californians already live under bag bans or taxes. And some of the cities that have banned them have seen a quite large reduction in bags that are used. So this has been successful in San Francisco and L.A. And so they just decided to expand it to the whole state. So this is the first state to do that.
Well, talk a little bit about what has happened here in Los Angeles in the last year. How much litter has it reduced? The ban?
Well, right now, Californians throw away about Californians throw away about 14 billion bags every single year, and that's about 123,000 tons of waste. So this will hopefully make a big difference throughout the state. And and it won't be every single bag. There's certain exemptions, such as bags for your unwrapped bulk items or prescription drugs. But environmental advocates are really hoping this will make a big difference.
Yeah. Well, grocery stores will still have paper bags to offer, correct?
Yes.
So what is the difference in terms of using plastic bags versus paper bags for the environment?
Well, in the past, paper bags were thought of as more of the environmentally friendly option, just because they are recyclable. But obviously, there's lots of disadvantages as well, such as deforestation. And there's actually one study which I found in my reporting where when you look at the actual global warming impact of producing bags, it's actually more energy to produce a paper bag. So you need to use a paper bag three times before the global warming impact equals having just used three separate plastic bags during that time. So under this current, under the current new law, paper bags will still be available for a 10-cent fee, so it would just be interesting to see how many people switched to using paper bags, which aren't necessarily that much better, and how many switched to using reusable or no bags at all.
Yeah, so what about that? Have there been any studies in terms of the effect of using those hybrid plasticky bags that are reusable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have. There's been some studies of California cities that have already enacted these bans, and it seems like people do start leaving the store with the no bag more often. 39% of customers started leaving the stores with no bag, just realizing they only had an item or two. It wasn't really necessary. And there was also a large increase in the number of people who used the reusable kind you can buy for usually a dollar or so at the checkout.
Mm-hmm. And are those good for the environment, using those bags instead?
Those are what environmental advocates tend to support. Similar to the paper bags, they are more energy intensive to produce, actually much more so. The kind that you might buy like right at the checkout, that will need to be used 11 times before it's better than having just used 11 plastic bags. So all of the environmentalists that I spoke with definitely support the switch to reusable bags, but it needs to just be, keep in mind that if you have a bunch of these that you've collected that you're not using, they did take a lot of energy to produce, and they're not really, counteracting that if they're just sitting around being unused.
Yeah. Something that I found really interesting in your article that I didn't know was that, you see the little recycling symbol on plastic bags, and so mm-hmm. I automatically assumed you could just put them in with the recycling. But you're actually not supposed to do that?
Yeah, that's actually a big problem. I spoke with someone in the San Francisco recycling plants where people accidentally throw them in just with everything else, and then they actually clog up the machines. And then there are special designated places. Sometimes you'll see them in a supermarket. That's a box designated just for plastic bags. But estimates of how many of them actually make it there is, somewhere between 3 and 11%.
You're supposed to set them aside and then return them to the grocery store? I guess
that would be the most environmental way to deal with them.
Right. Well, in general, though, so California is the first state to ban the plastic bag. I suppose other states will follow suit. Is this something that environmentalists are heralding as it going to be a huge disincentive to using plastic bags nationwide? As you said, Californians throw away about 14 billion of these bags a year. And are they a significant environmental problem?
Yeah, well, definitely environmental advocates are hoping that this will start to lead the way. It's kind of interesting across the country. There's 133 municipal bans already in cities and counties throughout the country. And there's actually several states that also have introduced legislation to either introduce bag fees or bag bans. Some of those states are Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. And interestingly, Hawaii, every county in Hawaii has a county ban. So they also have been pretty good at reducing their bags. But definitely environmentalists are hoping that this will move throughout the country.
All right. Katie Rose Kwan, Senior Editorial Fellow for Mother Jones. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers with the longest intro theme ever.
And my mic's on. Okay. The taking the plastic bags back, you also have to
That's
flip them inside
hurdle.
Out before you do it. And so if you like had them double bag or whatever,
really?
This is years ago and I still use plastic bags, but I used to sit in my living room like every quarter and just turn them inside out and have this ginormous trash bag full of them. Of course, I put them in a plastic bag to take them to go get recycled.
Nice.
So that was kind of a pain. Now I just use my Whole Foods Detroit bag. I like to rock that when I go into Ralph's, not Whole Foods. Okay, so today we talked to Zeke Emanuel. He plans to stop attempts to prolong his life at age 75. And we asked you all, do you all want to live as long as possible, no matter what? Or are you with Zeke Emanuel on this? Karen Meeker wrote on her Facebook page, she says that as a nurse, she completely agrees with Zeke Emanuel. The system is set up to prolong death, not increase quality of life, she says. And she says she has no interest in treating every ailment and slowly fading away, only to be remembered as an old lady who sat in a chair with food stains on her shirt. It is totally fine to not treat every single diagnosis and manage your own end-of-life experience. Jim Messias, however, says on Facebook that setting a hard age of 75 is ridiculous. It's arbitrary. He says, I have a feeling that if he hits 75 and is having fun, he'll change his mind, which I think has been one of the big criticisms.
Oh, absolutely. I have a feeling, given his mental and physical well-being, he'll be around a lot longer.
Right. And Joel Fogelson points out that Leonard Cohen, the musician, just released a new album at the age of 80. People who are over the age of 75 still have a lot to contribute to society and their families. I personally hope that Leonard Cohen lives another 30 years, more the better. And a final note from Peridot Arts on Facebook. She works in a nursing care facility, and many people there are kept alive by dialysis and other constant medical interventions, and only some of those people actually want to be alive. And she sees this all day. She says there was this one woman who was over the age of 90, like 93 or something. She had cancer, and doctors wanted to operate on her. She said no. The woman said no, and the doctors gave her a lot of flack for not wanting to intervene anymore, for her wanting to manage her own end-of-life care. But she says, Peridot Arts says, that's how I want to go. I'm with Zeke.
All right, so this obviously generates a lot of interest, a lot of comments. If you'd like to weigh in, we'd love to hear from you. We read all of our comments on Facebook, on Twitter, and we listen to our voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. I'm at The Mad Brand. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And Warren Olney, To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.